Here we go. KGNU listeners, welcome to Black Talk. I'd like to welcome in our usual listeners, and I'd also like to welcome new listeners. My name is Michelle Simpson, and Black Talk, for those of you who may be new to our program, Black Talk is a co-creation between the Boulder County NAACP and KGNU. Black Talk centers Black voices, Black thought, and Black vision. And I am so very, very pleased. We have such a special show for you today. As a matter of fact, this is a special edition of Black Talk, which is why it's airing today instead of our usual time. And I'd like to welcome first, we have two guests, but I'd like to welcome first to our show, Mr. Hughes Van Ellis. Now it's not Van Ellis, it's Hughes Van, middle name, Ellis. And Uncle Red, I am so deeply honored to have you join us today. And as you know, part of the reason why I wanted to talk to you is because you are one of the survivors who is left, one of the survivors of the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. And I have that right, correct?
Right.
Okay. And we're also featuring today Malie Kraft. So Miss Malie is Uncle Red's daughter. And through previous conversations, I learned that she had a story to tell. Who doesn't? But had a wonderful story to tell that really intersects nicely and aligns so nicely with her dad. So you're going to hear several voices today, and one of those will be hers. So Malie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you. So Uncle Red, just to start at the beginning, your family is originally from Oklahoma, correct?
Right.
Okay. You know, and I ask that because so many Black people migrated to Oklahoma. More specifically, many Black people migrated to Tulsa after the Civil War. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you to start, since we're going to be talking about the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, are you surprised that so few people know about the Tulsa Race Massacre?
I'm very surprised. I didn't think they would come up. Like a couple of years, my sister, she was only 6 years old when it happened.
Okay.
Her grandson, she was about a, had turned about 106 years old, 106, 100. And she mentioned about the, called the Tulsa Race Riot.
Uh-huh.
And it didn't know it for the best. And it's been going ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of interviews about it.
Right. No, I know you have. I know you have. So, Uncle Red, you were a baby when the Tulsa Race Massacre took place. Am I correct?
That's right. About 6 months old. Baby.
About 6 months old. Okay.
About 6 months old. Baby.
So can you tell us, based on what you've learned from your family and others, what happened? In other words, how did you survive? How did you survive the Tulsa Race Massacre? Because so many people died.
She said when it happened, people going down to college, get out to it. They set the house on fire, they burn it down the town. And she said, my dad managed, it happened late at night, and my dad managed to get us together. And we only had the clothes on our back. We couldn't save anything. He managed to get us out to safety some kind of way. And we we didn't have an automobile. We had just a horse and wagon.
Okay.
We managed to get on that horse and wagon.
Yeah, and get you out of town that way.
Yes.
So, Uncle Red, you are what? You are 101 years old.
Yes.
Do you think, when you think about the Tulsa Race Massacre, I'd asked you whether or not you were surprised that so few people knew about it. Why do you think so few people know about it?
Well, I think people want to share the news about stuff. See, all of that was never was mentioned all in many years. It never was mentioned. And a lot of people decided to hear about this. I understand different places. We were in Atlanta, Georgia, down there here a month or so ago on Christmas, and they had opened up what they call the Black Wall Street, hearing from what happened back in 1921. We have a what they call a Jessup Greenwood thing going, and it's going real well. And you can look on the CBS and it shows, and you see it all the time. You look on Facebook, it's all about Black Wall Street getting amongst the people. You know, young people should know, because young people are going to have to take this world and take it on. We're going to get old and pass our way. We want to just keep going.
So Black Wall Street was the name, the nickname of Greenwood, which was the Black business and resident district in Tulsa. Am I correct about that?
Right.
Okay. Now, Ms. Malie, tell me, because in conversations that we've had, you shared that you learned about the Tulsa Race Massacre just a few years ago. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Yes, I did. And again, my dad, my aunt, none of the other relatives ever mentioned the Tulsa Race Massacre. And that was because they were told, don't talk about it. I was born in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. I grew up in public schools all through up till I graduated from the 12th grade. And none of those years, nothing was ever talked about the race massacre. I had never heard of it. It was mentioned in school. We didn't read about it. So it really, for the past 100 years, has been a squashed topic, hidden, and they just cut that history out of the history, not only of Oklahoma, but people all across the country who never heard of it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let me ask you a question, though, because you were mentioning that none of your family members talked about it. What? And you said that they were told not to. Who told them not to, and kind of what stopped that?
My parents said, don't talk about it. Back when I was coming up, some of the kids tried to talk about it. They just wouldn't. It didn't want to talk about anything about the past. Our parents taught us that.
Do you think, Uncle Red, and perhaps you, Ms. Malie, do you think that had to do with some fear that if you talked about it, you could be hurt in some way?
Imagine so. They was afraid. And for some reason, maybe, our people didn't have no protection, like law protection, you know. Couldn't have a judge or couldn't have a lawyer, anything. We didn't live the best way we could. No rights for Black people back in then.
Got it.
You had to do what the white man did or what he said, and that's it.
Ms. Malie, what do you think?
I think it was, in addition to what Dad said, doing what the people said, but I think so many Black people wanted to have whatever little livelihood they could, and they wanted to keep what they, you know, the little bit they had. So they did not want to stir up any type of conflict.
I see what you're saying. That makes sense. No, that makes perfect sense that it was about survival. So, Uncle Red, tell us about Greenwood. Greenwood Avenue was considered the heart. Some called it the pulse of the Black business community.
It was the heart of the city. They had hospitals, grocery stores, police departments, tailor shops. They had most anything a Black man could have. They had a newspaper.
Right, yeah. In my research and reading, I understand that there were over 70 Black businesses that operated along that 100 block.
Over 70 Black. And a few supplies of business they had. There were businessmen that created companies.
Oh, yeah. No, when I look at the list, there were electricians and barbers and doctors and tailors, and there was a drugstore. A newspaper was there.
All trades handling modern cement guys done construction work.
Yeah, you name it. It was there. Hotels and all kinds of shops and so forth. So, absolutely. I remember reading a piece in the New York Times about Greenwood, known as the Black Wall Street, and it read as follows: that if you lived in Greenwood, you could shop for groceries, play pool, take in a theater show, eat dinner, or get your hair styled without ever leaving the block.
That's right.
Yeah. But you know, that was also as a result of segregation, because Black people were not permitted to shop in, you know, white stores or stay in white run hotels or, again, go to white theaters or see Black. You know, Black people, again, were segregated, but what we saw with Black Wall Street, this Greenwood district, where these businesses thrive, Black folks kind of made their own and created their own community.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did that feel? How did that look to you as a young person living in an environment like that with all these Black-owned businesses, people doing well, people working?
Yeah, it's exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I got 6 or 7, 8 years old, and my sister Barbara started telling me about it. And then after that, in the early 30s, she moved back there and married. And they still had nice stuff then. And they had their own theaters and their shops and drugstores, grocery stores. They had a grocery store that you could get your basket, go around, groceries. Yeah.
Yeah, because as I said, when I look at the list, there's so many. The Economy Drugstore, the Hotel Gurley, the Dixie Theater, East End Donut Shop, W.J. Tate Electrician, R.T. Bridgewater Physician, Byers and Anderson, the Tailors. I mean, it just goes on and on. Bell and Little Cafe. Yeah, I mean, it just goes on. And so, again, I'm sure, and you were just saying that, you felt good about that. You know, you felt some pride in living in a place where Black people were kind of living and working. And I don't by any means want to indicate that everybody was a business owner, that everybody was prosperous. I mean, you also had working people, people who worked as shoe shiners, people who cleaned in other people's homes, waitresses and that type of thing.
Yes.
So what stories, Uncle Red, I mean, when you think about Greenwood, when you think about that whole district, because when this came about, when these businesses developed, when this whole residential area developed, Black folks were just about 6 decades out of slavery. So what stories, if any, did you learn about the slave era and what Black people endured during that time? Did you ever hear any stories about that?
Well, I heard that they have put the, every year they have what, 15 something. They're supposed to be in, let people leave from slavery and do their own thing. You were free from slaves.
Oh, Juneteenth.
So Oklahoma is called the black people out of Nicodemus, Kansas, went to Oklahoma. It was in the, but was a place sticking out? The Panhandle.
Oh, okay.
They were the first people that had what they called a land rush. They were the first people rushed to stake the land.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They came out of Nicodemus' tents. So they were the first. They were in the land where they were the first people that did that. If you rush down in this little lake running out in Oklahoma in a panhandle, and you would see people running out there staking the land.
Got it.
And they staked the land, or they even built after they staked it. When they staked the land, they built their homes on it and everything. And if it was farming, they'd farm on it. And I understand when they did that, the other type of people come and break the homes up and burn them down. So they would just go on and on about how hard it was for a black man to make a living even after he was born.
Even after, right, even after emancipation. So let me ask you this. In 1921, Greenwood was this 35-block neighborhood. As I said, it had, you know, vibrant retail sector, two schools, two newspapers. As you mentioned, Uncle Red, there was a hospital, you name it. Again, it was a self-contained community. One of the schools there was Booker T. Washington School. Do you know anyone who attended Booker T. Washington?
Yeah. Back about it, when I went to Tulsa, when I was a 9 or 10 year old kid, I was born first from the high school of Booker T. Washington School. And the name of the people, they were very intelligent. They were sport people, just the Latimers. The latter was popular in the early 30s, and they went to the Booker T. Washington High School, and they learned to run the track. And some of them sang, or some of them were dancers. And their father, latter, he had a building. He built a store at the end of Greenwood and Pine, and he had a business there. The latter was building, they were all for their school, very intelligent black people. And one or two other people I remember, their family was really nice too. They, two, three families, very proper back in the early days.
They also attended Booker T.
Yeah, they attended the Booker T. Washington High School.
You know, Uncle Red, tell us a little bit more about your family, because again, at the top, I asked you whether you were originally from Oklahoma. And I thought I remembered you telling me that your family, they were sharecroppers. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, we were what they call sharecroppers. We would go from town to town looking for work. So when you go to one town and we couldn't find no work, those sharecroppers, we just moved from town to town. We went up in Kansas. I didn't tell you that before. We lived in Kansas one time.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, yes. And so my dad finally had a job on construction, building street roads and stuff. And then he done a little railroad work, I'm understanding. A lot of time we stay on the railroad, on the railroad track houses.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So we was back and forth trying to find work. And after I grew up and started a family for myself, that's what I had to do. Raising kids, I had three girls and four boys. And so sometimes I had to work two jobs, you know, to take care of them.
Of course.
You go on a job, you may not get it. You were afraid to ask for it.
Well, Uncle Red, tell me about sharecropping, because I'm not certain everybody knows what that is.
Sharecropping is, you go on a guy, this guy would have a farm, he'd go on that farm, and you reap the harvest all his cotton and corn and stuff and potatoes, and then he would take it to town for sell it. And as you said it, you split the money between you and the guy that owned the stuff.
Okay.
So in the wintertime, you have to make enough to get you through the winter. If you didn't, the guy on the farm would let you have enough food to get you through the winter. And when the time for harvest, you take the stuff and sell it, and you bring back the money, and he takes the money out of what you owe him. You couldn't have much cash. Most of the thing was traded. Black man didn't have too much cash.
Mm-hmm.
You had a $1, you really had a lot of money.
Yeah, and as I understand it, many people who work...
wasn't much money transferred. You just swap stuff.
What I was going to say is, as I understand it, because some of my family members were sharecroppers, that it was close to impossible to ever get ahead and to be able to purchase your own land or to move out of sharecropping because you were constantly in debt.
Right.
You know, during those months when, again, you weren't, again, harvesting a crop or what have you, and the amount of money that you would make sharecropping wasn't enough that you could ever quite get ahead. So you remained in servitude or in service to whoever that landowner was. So, Miss Malie, what did you know about, again, your family's history when it came to moving around, trying to find work? Because that's also part of your history.
Yes. Well, basically, my dad told me some things about sharecropping, moving around. And then when I was trying to actually help him get a passport 1 year, he told me, you know, different towns they lived in, Holdenville, Oklahoma, they lived in Nowata, Oklahoma, they lived
Fairfax.
So he told me there was so many communities, and then they would have to drop out of school in the springtime to go do sharecropping. And so my aunt also told me that, you know, she never did really finish a grade. You know, they'd work up till maybe, I don't know, April or something. And then they go to school up until April, and then they have to sharecrop. And so you just kind of went from year to year, and you know, you learn what you could from year to year, but you were in different, you know, you were probably in a different school district, a different community from year to year because of the sharecropping.
Exactly. Yeah, that was my understanding as well. You know, Uncle Red, there have been so many stories told in a few documentaries about Black Wall Street, about the Greenwood Business District. And I just wanted to say again, I hinted at this a little earlier, that sometimes those stories fail to center the stories and the lives and the histories of waiters, of chauffeurs, shoe shiners, maids and cooks who resided in Greenwood as well. I mean, you had homeowners and you also had renters. You had people who were renting as well. And to just underscore the fact that Greenwood came about due to segregation. Again, Black folks weren't permitted to patronize white establishments. So we developed our own. You know, we ended up developing our own.
Hold on.
You are listening to Black Talk on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins, and Nederland. I wanted to come back to the Tulsa Race Massacre and just explore that a little further. So Uncle Red, apparently you were 6 months old. So in terms of your memories really have come to you through some of the stories of your family members. What did they tell you, if you can recall, what did they tell you about the morning of June 2nd, 1921?
About June 2nd, 1921.
Because what actually led to the massacre began on May 30th?
What led to it, they said there was this black guy, he was a shoe shiner. He had to go to the bathroom. He couldn't go to the bathroom. And the white man, he had to catch the elevator so he could go to the bathroom to the black side of town. So when he boarded this elevator, this baby screamed. And from there, the black man, they let him go and he just left town. I don't want to have to the black. I don't want to have to the white lady, but anyway, then she got out. So after that, this black guy played him out, said it was 4-5 World War number soldiers, World War I. Said they tried to help settle it, and it was a shot fired, and that set off the whole thing. When the shot was fired, people was running, trying to get to safety, and also they were dropping bombs on the back area, and people running and screaming and going on, said, get out of town, get out, go to safety, said.
Yeah.
People were shooting up people and just went on that way for this, you know, at that time for hours, you know. So,
yeah, that's my understanding. Yeah, that's my understanding too, Uncle Red. You know, in terms of researching the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, what I learned, again, aligns with the story you just shared, that the story I think most frequently repeated is that a young black man, Dick Rowland, who was 19 years old, as you said, a black shoe shiner, he entered an elevator that was operated by Sarah Page, who was a white 17-year-old. And so it was said that he lost his footing in the elevator because, you know, elevators sometimes are off balance, and especially those all old ones. Yeah, those old kind. And he reached out as he was trying to steady himself, and he grabbed her arm in an attempt to steady himself. She screamed, he ran, and the interaction grew into an accusation after rumors began to swirl of a sexual assault. And so Mr. Rowland was arrested. He was jailed. And the Tulsa Tribune, they ran a headline saying, "Nab Negro for attacking girl in elevator." And you had a group, as you just mentioned, of Black Tulsans, many who were World War I veterans, who offered to help protect Mr. Rowland because a Black man in a prison who had been accused of raping or assaulting a white woman was going to be lynched. So they offered to protect him, and they made a couple of offers to the powers that be, and their offers were turned down or rejected. And so evidently this group of Black Tulsans, these World War I veterans, were leaving, and a white man tried to disarm one of the Black veterans. A gun went off, as you said. There was a scuffle that ensued. And so this incident is what many refer to as the spark that actually caused this Tulsa Race Massacre to essentially kind of ignite. So you had white men who were armed and who were also deputized by civil officials in Tulsa. Right. And then near dawn, an armed white mob descended on Greenwood, this district that we were just talking about. Right. And the Black Tulsans were outnumbered. They fought back, but they were outnumbered. Black people, as you said, were just shot randomly on site. The white mob moved into the area and ransacked homes. They stole jewelry, money. They set fires.
They'd go in the home and set the curtains for, and they'd be looking for black people.
Yeah, that's what I read.
Carolyn, the other name, Miss Reynolds, she was small too. And she said she was living with her grandmother and said he died and come in the house and he's looking for the black men, and then they set the curtain apart and go out. Leave it.
Yeah.
No way. You didn't know why to put the fire out. You had to leave that out.
Yeah, you had to leave the house to burn in order to save your own life. And as I understood it, they set fires, as you just said, they went house by house, block by business block. And then you had, this was 1921, you had white pilots that flew airplanes and dropped dynamite over Greenwood.
Dynamite on the air.
Yeah. I mean, and what resulted from that is you had 35 blocks that were burned. You had 300 dead. You had hundreds injured. You had about 8,000 to 10,000 who were left homeless. You had about 1,500 homes burned and looted, and about 6,000 who were detained in internment camps. So, yeah, I mean, this was devastating. I mean, this was beyond horrendous. You know, Miss Malie, what did you hear once you learned several years ago? Is this what you heard when you learned a bit more about the 1921 Tulsa race massacre?
Yes, I did. I heard what you said. Also, I heard that those people that survived came back to try to get their money out the bank, because some people had money in the bank, and the
National Bank.
And the bankers were saying, "Well, where's your bank slip, or where?" And everything had been burnt up. And so I heard that many Black people were basically, their money that they had on deposit, it was stolen from them. They were never given a dollar. And the bankers said, "Well, you don't have documentation, and it's too bad." And so people really had to start from scratch.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that part of the story in terms of that.
Family, mm-hmm. Because all of the possessions were burnt up. We really don't have anything like pictures or anything from that era, because it was destroyed.
Right, right. I hadn't heard that part of the story. About people trying to get money, you know, from banks. And so I didn't realize that. Boy, you know, the story just grows. The story just grows, you know, the more you hear about it. And I understand that parts of Greenwood, so in the aftermath, parts of Greenwood was rebuilt, but the story of what happened remained silenced. And so Greenwood endured for several decades, even after this 1921 massacre that took place. But then urban renewal, you know, the building of highways, what's happened in Black communities throughout the United States that have been destroyed through various means, whether it's gentrification or, again, what people call urban renewal that my mom used to always refer to as Black removal, took its toll, as did other factors. So Uncle Red or Malie, do you know or have any sense of what happened to those residents, what happened to those survivors?
Some of those survivors, some of them dead, most of them. And every now and then you see some young people, their grandparents or parents who said lived in that area.
Uh-huh.
And then you run across some of the young suffer, you know, from like I'm 100 years old, like they did. That Mrs. Reynolds, she got a granddaughter who takes care of her.
Okay.
Mrs. Reynolds would have killed herself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only what we tell them or to know. It's most of those young people are, there's a few of them living in there, like in the 50s and 60s. And they just hear from a story. There's nobody living to tell them actually. And just remember what my sister told me, like I'm 6 months old. My sister was about 9 years, maybe. My sister was about 6 years old. And she just tell me what she remembered.
I got it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
And what I heard, Michelle, is some families moved away. Some people moved to Wichita, Kansas.
Yeah.
Some people moved to California. You know, there was some families that some people moved to Oklahoma City. Arkansas. They went various places. Some people went to Chicago, just trying to start a new life.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. So, you know, both of you, the question that comes for me, and you may not have kind of firsthand information about this, but what did people do? In other words, what did people do to deal with the trauma, you know, of the destruction that was once their home? And I don't mean their physical homes, but I mean this whole district that had been their home. How did people deal with just the kind of the massive devastation and destruction?
Well, I believe, and from what the little information I've got, is they suppressed it. They also might have, like my aunt, for example, my dad, they don't like sleeping in the dark. You know, they have certain things that have carried through their life all these years, which were a direct impact of the massacre.
So, so when you say, Ms. Malie, when you say not sleeping in the dark, tell me a little bit more about that. What does that look like? What do you mean?
Well, like my aunt, for example, she doesn't sleep in the bed. She sits up in a chair and she has a little light on. And that's how she sleeps. I have never known her ever to sleep
in
the bed. My dad, he likes to have a light on.
I play the light all night.
Yeah.
I just don't sleep good at night, never have.
But, you know, but Ms. Believe, what you're saying makes sense in many ways. People being ready, you know, trying to be vigilant in case something happens.
In case something happens, you know, that something could happen. They may have to jump up and go again years later. But, you know, they've seen, like I've seen things happen in the news and incidents. Even during the 50s, you know, the civil rights era.
Oh, yeah.
Where the people's houses were burnt and the people had to, they had to go. They had to be.
Yeah, and leave quickly. Yeah, leave quickly if they survived it. Yeah, but have to leave really, really quickly. You know, another question that comes up for me when I think about the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre has to do with so many of the conversations that are taking place today. Especially amongst young people, conversations about generational wealth and the fact that we're having a lot of those conversations about a lack of generational wealth within Black families. And when you look at what happened on Black Wall Street, when you look at what happened in this Greenwood district, it gives us some indication of some of the violence, because what happened in Greenwood didn't just happen in Greenwood. As you just mentioned, it happened other places where people had to be constantly vigilant. So what could you pass down in terms of generational wealth to your family when you didn't have a home? Or again, you didn't have kind of the insurance policies and the other things that some of your white counterparts might have. So it's almost as if you talked about people leaving and having to start again, Uncle Rhett, Emily, but it feels like we've started again, just as a people, because we've had to start from scratch in so many ways, because we haven't had the wherewithal, the tools, because of segregation, to build that generational wealth.
Exactly. And the pioneers, those individuals in 1921, the Blacks who had businesses, many, many, many of them were killed, murdered. They had no opportunity to pass any of their knowledge on to family members. So then it's like the people who survived were starting from scratch again.
No, absolutely.
And what I think about is like, what you know, what if the hotels or the salons or different things would have been able to thrive? You know, we could have had a hotel chain like Marriott or Hilton. We could have had a hair salon chain like Cost Cutters that, you know, have thrived over the years.
but our livelihood was just squashed for us.
Right, right. And as I said, what happened in the Greenwood District, what happened on Black Wall Street isn't singular. It happened other places. And so we're just starting to hear more about those stories and learn more about the devastation. But again, this was a regular occurrence, not necessarily to the extent that we saw with Black Wall Street, but it happened. And it happened in various pockets in various areas of the country. You know, Uncle Red, do you ever think about Greenwood? Do you ever think about Tulsa, Oklahoma? Do you ever dream about it?
Oh, yeah. Every day. It's in my mind.
And what do you think about? Yeah, what do you think about?
I served in the United States Army 2.5 years. And back in Tulsa during the riot, we were bombed. It dropped bombs on the heaven, dynamite. That's what they did. A lot of people wasn't even buried. A lot of people was thrown in the river. In the Arkansas River.
Yeah, I've heard about mass graves and that type of thing, but that's what happened.
I heard other years, I heard that they burned black people up in houses. Yeah, some of the others, but I think Tulsa was the worst, the massacre.
So Uncle Red, how did you respond when you were a member of the military and bombs were being dropped then?
Well, you'd be getting out of the way, you'd be getting under cover somewhere. We had things, what's it called? The radar would tell you when the enemy plane would come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a gun unit, so we had to be ready. We had what's it called, camouflage over our area.
We had
a thing called a radar machine. It went around and around, and it would pick up the sound of a plane. And we'd get ready for it.
Uncle Red, what happened when you got out of the military? When you got out of the military, did you come back to Oklahoma? What did you do?
I came back to Oklahoma.
Uh-huh. And how was it when you came back? Was it better? Was it different? Was it the same?
Same. I came back and had a chance to work for a federal job called the Cape Air Base Field and they started letting all black people, you know, all the dirty way, going to grease and all that stuff, and cleaning up the area where when they transferred, finally started letting black people work on the plane. And what they do, they had a black man, when they break down the engine, be all and stuff, and on the floor, they had you mop that up. Still had you doing dirty work. And you had a black water fountain and a white water fountain. That's what you see. You go in a store, you couldn't buy nothing.
Oh, you were telling me about that. Tell us a little bit more about that.
If you purchased something, you had to point at it. You wasn't allowed to try anything on. That happened for years. You wasn't allowed to try a shoe on, or you had to guess at the stuff like people did in the early 20s.
And Malie, you learned about that as well, did you not? Because I remember talking to you about that, people going to the store and having, say, a piece of yarn or a piece of thread that they had measured their foot width or their arm length with, because as a black person, you weren't allowed to try on clothes?
Exactly. My dad told me about it, my aunt. But what brought it to me, I was in my early 20s. And I went to Chicago in 19, it was about 71. And I could not, I just couldn't believe it. When we went to a store on the west side of town, and they had the produce department had a turnstile that had it roped off. And you could not go in that section. You had to point. You had to say, can I have an apple? Whatever you wanted. And that just, it shook me as a young black person. And I have reflections of what my dad had talked about in the early 1900. I just couldn't believe that. And so that just kind of brought it home for me. And then even in Oklahoma City, which is where I was born and grew up, they had the movie theater. Black people could only go to the movie, I believe it was a certain day of the week.
Monday
or something like that, through a weekend. And, you know, those things just brought chills. They still bring chills to me when I think about that and what people went through.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's heartbreaking.
And, you know, even for those of us who didn't directly go through it, who've heard the stories, who've read the stories, who've seen, you know, some of the stories on in film or what have you, or in documentaries, you know, there's this kind of racial trauma that we hold, you know, in our bodies, in our minds, that's still with us. So whether or not, again, we lived during that time or not, there is a belief, and I'm one who believes, that we hold that trauma.
We do. And see, I can remember we would come to Colorado once a year, usually like 4th of July or something.
What brought you to Colorado?
My mother had two sisters who moved here in the 50s, and we would come once a year.
Okay.
And I recall us coming through, sometimes we go through New Mexico, Texas, New Mexico, come up to Colorado, we go through Kansas, come over to Colorado. But I remember we stopping at a gas station and they would not sell us any gas. And to this day, my dad is 101 years old. That was still traumatizing for me, and it's traumatizing for him. To this day, he will not let his tank get below a half. He has to get gas. And if I'm driving him somewhere and my tank gets low, he gets mad about it. He stop and put some gas in that car.
Right.
Yeah, so you're not stuck.
And that's tied to what we went through.
Right.
With us.
Yeah, not being stuck somewhere where somebody's not going to permit you to purchase gas. No, and that's why I'm saying those stories. And sometimes they're with us, Malia, in a way that we're not even aware. They just become a part of how we live our lives. And yes. And as I said, that imprint, that trauma just remains. You know, so many people now, and I shouldn't say so many, but more people, let me correct myself. More people are starting to learn about the Tulsa Race Massacre in 1921. And this question is for the both of you. What do you want, so the people who are listening to this program, for example, or may listen in the future, what is it that you want people to take away from what happened? What is it that you want them to feel or think or do? What is it that you want people to take away from what happened?
Well, first, I encourage everyone. I encourage you to read about it. There are some documentaries out there to watch. Them.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I encourage you. Do that. Secondly, if you know of any seniors, African-American seniors, talk with them. Talk with them and see what they went through. And then I encourage particularly the young people today.
The young people especially.
The young people today, that you need to know your history, but at the same time, you want to be proud of who you are, and that you want to know, you need to be informed.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know as much as you can and be informed, and because that's going to carry you far.
Yeah.
If you are informed, don't be in the dark. And I tell young people, you know, I tell them, I said, now, if I gave you a test about you know, Michael Jordan or somebody, oh, you could tell me everything. His shoe size is a 15 and blah, blah, blah. You need to have the same information on and want to know the same information about our history, what our ancestors have been through, because it's going to help you go forward, and you would be able to help young people, would be able to help other people,
mm-hmm.
because it's been a struggle. They don't really understand discrimination. They don't understand that. And I've experienced discrimination myself. And not only back in the day, you know, Black people, you couldn't have a front job for any kind of front job. You could not work in the front. Everything you did had to be in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And so young adults today, they take it for granted if they're, you know, working in a front position. And I encourage them, I say, you need to be proud. You want to come to work looking presentable. You want to have a conversation that's presentable, because so many of us, we went through so much to get where we are today. And we went through so much where the younger adults are where they are today. And that was based on our, you know, the sweat and tears and just the things that we had to go through in order to make work environment, living situations, all of that, to make that available. And, you know, young people don't think about, Macy's, they try on 10 pair of shoes. Back in my day and before, you couldn't try on one pair.
No.
Yeah.
You could not. And so they need to be more aware of what we have gone through in order for the world to be a better place.
Yeah, and young, especially the young generations. The younger generations is taught different. So they need to be taught the truth. What went on, what's happening today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Their parents teach them to tell them the truth. It's been led about Black people. Some generation, most generation, really don't know who we are. So we need justice, but not only Greenwood, we need justice for us. So I'm asking the authority, give us justice. Young people have to know about us. I think we'll be better. All races. We're called Black. The other race is called brown. They know quite a bit about brown people, but they don't know about Black people. So let it get to the younger generations in colleges, books, justice.
Uncle Red?
Yes.
Miss Malie, thank you so, so very much for your time, for your stories, for kind of opening up your lives and your experiences to us. I can't thank you enough. And, you know, as you're talking about history, this is Black History Month. And what I want everybody to understand is, even though we're kind of shedding a spotlight on Black history, we're talking about American history. What happened in 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, affected all of us. And we're living with the aftermath. We're all living with the repercussions of that today. All of us. It's not just, again, looking at the experiences of Black folks during that time and shaking your head or wringing your hands and thinking, boy, wasn't that terrible? so much of, again, what we've been talking about today continues. When we look at discrimination, when we look at unfair treatment, when we look at a lack of equity and equality. So just a reminder that, again, this is Black History Month. It's American History Month. And that should be all year round, not just relegated to 28 days. But on that note, Uncle Red, I can't thank you enough. I'll have you on next year when you're 102. And Ms. Malie, thank you so much for agreeing to join us. It has been just my deepest pleasure to have you both.
We want to thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Taking your time out to do this.
Anytime. Anytime. It has been my pleasure. Thank you both so, so very much.
Sun.